Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, or good night, or whatever. Anyway, welcome to this week's Document TV International. And welcome to our American thinker, Charles Ortel. Welcome to you,
Thanks
Charles.
Thanks for having me on, Gar.
Thank you for coming on with us. It's a great pleasure to have you on. We have a lot of topics. And actually, there's a queue of people waiting to get into the studio, so let's get started. Of course, this week's big thing, and that is why I dropped the American Thinker. Your last tweet was on a piece in American Thinker, which I know you always, sometimes write for anyway. And now the big question is, who made that blast of the Nord Stream undersea pipelines?
Well, you know, immediately in the U.S. and the English press and some of the Western press, Russia was blamed. And it is, of course, anything is possible, but Russia was delivering a large volume of gas into the West via this pipeline and was set to do more. It doesn't make any sense for Russian interests to blow this up, I don't think. And it makes a lot more sense, on the other hand, to follow the breadcrumbs that were laid out by Joe Biden himself and Victoria, the odious Victoria Nuland, who said prior to the invasion that if Russia invaded Ukraine or conducted this special military operation, that the U.S. had ways of destroying these pipelines. So this is an area where I would hope cool heads would prevail, and we would think through who have interests in eliminating or making it difficult to get this pipeline back up and running. And once we get through all that, from an American perspective, I feel it's critically important to understand whether or not we had any direct or indirect involvement. Because this is really, if we did, if contractors or if the government itself was involved with this, this is really horrible. This undercuts our moral authority as a nation, if we have any left, because the practical job of getting energy back into Europe now in a reliable way to heat and make sure that across our allies, our former allies, I should say, or our weakened allies in Europe, that we ameliorate this dread problem. The thought that some knucklehead in Langley or the Pentagon would think this might be a good idea, and the fact that the President of the United States and a team around him have not credibly said immediately, we had nothing to do with this, is, I think, significant cause for concern.
Definitely. And the other day, I noted that I think it was the German Minister of Energy who said that this is gonna exacerbate our energy crisis. I thought, why? Putin already stopped the gas due to that valve failure in that pump station, which was sent to Canada and then went back and forth, and finally was sent back to Russia. After that, all the gas stopped, all the gas flow stopped. And same way, the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs said that this is going to exacerbate the energy situation and the crisis, energy crisis of Europe. How come? Well, Europe hasn't received any Russian gas since early September, late August. Anyway, so I find this smelly, and you know it's methane gas that has leaked out from the sites. Actually, there seems to be four explosions or four leaks in the pipelines. Now,
well,
please go ahead.
Yeah, I think this. I mean, to your point, there was a hope and a prayer that, you know, if maybe we actually had, if the U.S. or others forced peace talks, which I think the U.S. could say to Zelensky, listen, dude, you've had enough bread. If we had a chance to forge a peace back in April, this isn't going well for the people of Europe and for, frankly, people around the world with the inflation. You're going to participate meaningfully in peace talks. If we, prior to this episode with the pipelines, if we would be on a course where we could forge a peace. and then where there could be a return to normalized gas flows. Now I don't see that prospect for some time. I mean, I'm not an engineer, but I imagine it's pretty difficult if you have a pipeline that's taking on salt water and spewing gas all over the place. It's pretty difficult to put that mess back together and have confidence that it's going to work properly. I don't think natural gas from the U.S. can replace what's lost. Maybe some from Norway can. But this is really a very serious problem that must be raising anxiety levels for households across Europe.
And across Norway, just on the point of repair or not repair, I read somewhere yesterday, I think it was again a German minister who said that the pipelines cannot be repaired.
Yeah.
No, why I spoke about Norway, you mentioned Norway. Norway might be able to replace some. Actually, Norway has increased its export of natural gas to Europe by pipelines to Europe by some 20%, I believe. And of course, that is very profitable for the Norwegian state coffers. Not so for the Norwegian or the South Norwegian population and business community, because we also opened underwater power cables, electricity cables to Germany and Britain last year, which has made, and we have spoken about this earlier, energy prices or electricity prices in southern Norway outrageous. We have a lot of oil and gas installations in the North Sea and even in the Arctic Sea. And now there was a meeting the day before yesterday regarding safety of the Norwegian oil installations. And today I posted a National News Agency story with an expert on the security matters who said, I would be surprised if someone hasn't already mined the underwater or the pipelines, the Norwegian pipelines already.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we have in this country, frankly, a conflicted fool running the FBI who has acceded to the idea that the most dangerous threat inside this country is so-called domestic white extremists. In fact, you point to a danger which I, as somebody who has operated in business in the energy field around the world, understand reasonably well. A lot of these installations, these critical installations, are very difficult to defend. Or put differently, they're in remote locations. If they were overwhelmed by eco-terrorists, they could do grave damage, not simply in Norway, but around the world, around America, which is a huge place. I know from having been on the board of a natural gas compression company, one of the biggest in the world, a private company, that a lot of those critical installations are out in the middle of nowhere in our American West, in Alaska, in Siberia, elsewhere. And so we have these fanatics, these eco-terrorists, who are cheered on by academia, cheered on by the left, frankly, cheered on by Pete Buttigieg and these idiots in the Biden administration. And they're all, I bet you, chomping at the mouth, looking for their moment of glory now. And I sincerely hope security services around the world are monitoring this very carefully, because we do not want suddenly to find ourselves in size without energy in a cold winter.
Absolutely not. The security community in Norway and the politicians had a meeting two nights ago. And they said, of course, tried to appease tried to placate the public and say, well, yeah, we have increased the security levels, and people buy it, not realizing that our Navy, our Coast Guard, our armed forces are so minuscule and have such a big territory to defend and right. to surveil that they cannot do the job from the beginning. Actually, I quoted a former general, Norwegian general, no more with the Red Cross, who earlier this summer wrote a biting opinion, op-ed piece in the financial paper, one of the financial papers, where he said, ironically, I think that the armed forces of Norway, or rather what is left of them, would be better protected in East Ukraine than in Norway. How about that one?
Wow.
So, I mean, you spoke about eco-terrorists. I think that the politicians and the Norwegian audience at large are thinking, did Russia do it? Can they hit our installations as well? I don't have that fear. My fear is more national. We've discarded our own armed forces, our defense systems. We have a police force who couldn't find a bat in the broad daylight, no, definitely not at night. We're so wokeified in Norway that you won't believe it. That, so my, right. The big scare for me is the lack of national leadership. Jens Stoltenberg, right. Our former prime minister from the Labour Party, is now Secretary General of NATO. NATO put most of their resources and sold so much weapons that the weapon factories, also in Norway, are working overtime to fill the need. Well, okay, that brings cash into somebody's pockets, but it doesn't strengthen our security. And as a Norwegian, right. I'm bound to take Norwegian security into consideration before I speak about European security. Of course, I see that Europe is in a big security mess, on top of the energy mess that they put themselves into.
Right. Yeah, when history is written on this period, the period 1989-92 forward, it will be a stunning, I think, retrospective, assuming history is written other than in, Chinese, by the Han Chinese. People are going to look back at the arrogance and the stupidity that has driven so many pompous bureaucrats to preen around the world at fancy speeches, flying private, staying in hotel suites, covering themselves with medals and glory, and basically not playing cards properly that were dealt to us by 89-92, when if instead of financing unregulated and unchecked globalist dreams that have been proven manifestly ineffective across Africa, in the poorest countries of the world, and across, indeed, Europe, if we had gone and said, you know what, the best way to strengthen a nation is not to start with the government, to start with the family, and then move to the community and the city and then the region and the nation state. If we had each nation in its own way, and Norwegian people have their great heritage and their way of thinking, which is different than the Swedes, perhaps, and the Danes, and the not to mention Portuguese and across Europe, if each of us had sought excellence in our own ways and not, just transferred authority and responsibility to a bunch of gnomes in Strasbourg and in Brussels who could then burn money around the world and congratulate themselves, we would all be a lot better off. Instead, we are at knife's edge on a precipice, facing perhaps World War III, facing environmental crisis, facing an energy crisis, facing a population decline crisis. And why we listen to Stoltenberg and other national leaders is beyond me. I certainly don't.
You dropped a lot of important keywords here, Charles. We spoke about Africa. I spoke about wokeism. You spoke about Strasbourg and Brussels. I'll include the seat of the World Evil Forum in Davos as well. Did you know that Norway has been hosting the Nordic Africa Business Summit these days?
I did not get an invitation.
Neither did I, even though I have extensive experience with corruption in Nigeria and South Sudan. And I wrote a report to the Minister of Foreign Affairs on it, and they just shrugged their shoulders and said, tell us something new. But still, leave the business summit aside, Norway, and that was a story that broke last night, Norwegian time, just handed out 200 million Norwegian crowns to Norfund, which is the Norwegian Ministry of Development and AIDS investment fund for sustainable development in developing countries. Read, no fossil fuels, renewable energy sources, etc. So these 200 million comes atop 400 million given last year to build three huge wind farms in South Africa. Now, I happened to see a movie from South Africa, partially financed by a document this Tuesday. It was a good movie, but it was a depressing movie too. And I have friends in South Africa that I've spoken to this week, and they tell me, my friend is reveling reveling in the fact that Europe has gotten itself into such a mess. At least, he said, we have nice weather here. And he's right. But back to that, those wind farms. Today, I found out that a business paper in South Africa, Business Tech, published statistics on unemployment. The unemployment rate in South Africa hovers around 36%. The title of yesterday's piece was, South Africa is in for an unemployment shock. Very soon, unemployment general, all age groups, will cross into the 40%, cross above 40%. And we also have, I haven't substantiated those figures, but that amongst the young population up to 25, the unemployment rate is closer to 60. Now, Business Tech wrote an interesting thing. They said that the national energy company, I think it's Ecos, I might get the name wrong, but anyway, because they have to adhere to the Paris Treaty, they have to take 10 megawatt off. They have to close down more coal farms. And coal is, the little electricity they have today is more or less from coal plants, coal-fired plants. And what would that mean? If they are to adhere to the Paris Treaty, they have to lay off another 100,000 coal miners. How about that? How smart
is that? Well, it's straight up stupid. I mean, when you start with the Paris Accord, it's meaningless because China's not going to abide by it, and China's building, coal plants every week, and is a major consumer of coal. And before we get into, questioning the mathematical calculations in the models, which claim that we have this type of problem in the first place, leave that aside. Let's assume the model's okay. The treaty is deeply flawed. And when we turn to South Africa, sadly, the last I checked, South Africa is actually one of the richer economies per capita GDP across Africa. I think the richest, isn't it, Equatorial Guinea, which is not exactly a model we want to follow.
Nigeria has the largest economy. I think they surpassed South Africa a few years back. South Africa has the second largest economy, and Ethiopia was on the way to catch up with them, but then they got themselves involved in another war.
Right, but I'm talking per capita, per person. So okay, South Africa is much smaller than Nigeria, and Ethiopia is gigantic. But my point is that when I was in college, in the last millennium, one of the things I did was study African economics and politics, and I had the fortune, thanks to my parents, to travel across really all over Africa back in the mid-70s. And you know, for all of these reports and all of your grants and all of the other grants that have gone into Africa, I hazard a guess that the situation on a per capita, per person basis in Africa with regard to the economy is worse today in 2022 than it was way back when, especially considering the situation there relative to the situation in the United States or in other countries whose economies are maybe foundering now, but much better off than they were in the 70s. And this for all of these PhDs and development types who, you know, love to swan in and go on a 10-day or a 30-day working tour with Bill Clinton on his 10-day private jet jaunts around Africa, virtue signaling and claiming that they're doing good work. I think that people of Africa, I don't speak for them, obviously, but they want to define their futures in their own ways, but they would ideally like to have clean water, clean sanitary facilities, access to medicine, the hope that they could create conditions for the business people to manufacture products and services for sale on the African market, on the global market. None of that is possible when you have no energy infrastructure, where power is intermittent at best. And, you know, the electricity consumption per capita is one of the tightest ratios or metrics that you could use to think about whether a country has a prayer. Instead of letting Africa grow the way it should be able to grow, when you go, the countries are vast, the continent is much bigger than Western maps suggest, and the people there are vibrant and hard and interested to work. I mean, what we have done with our development programs in the main is disgusting, frankly.
Absolutely. And you said what they would like probably is clean water and clean food. Absolutely, too. But the last thing on their mind is clean energy. The first thing on their mind is energy.
Right.
Energy, whatever.
Yeah. Like when I plug the plug in, the fan should work, kind of.
Exactly. Now, by the way, have you come across any Norwegians on your walks in New York, Charles?
From time to time, actually, Norwegians are, you know, as you know better than I, they're adventurous travelers. We see a lot of French people. For some reason, French have a high propensity to travel, but I would warn people thinking about coming to New York that it is very dangerous, particularly after dark. We have, not just anecdotal tales of this person getting punched or murdered or worse, but the crime rates, the statistics are way up. And you just have to be very careful walking the streets of this and other big American cities after dark.
I think it might be better to go to the countryside of North Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota, these parts of the country. But I have to tell you, why I asked you is that this last month we've established, we got ourselves another correspondent in the U.S. Great. And hopefully I'll bring the two of you together one day. She's living in Florida. She still speaks Norwegian. And she writes for us. Obviously, she knows how to speak and write Norwegian. But that gave me, or some of us, the thought that if we have any sons of Norway, sons or daughters of Norway over there in Uniten, as the old people used to say, over the sea, who happens to watch us, why don't you watch us more? And why don't you tell your friends? We know we have like 3-4 million of Norwegian descent in all over the U.S. if it's not more, and they ought to watch us, Charles.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure there are Norwegian American friendship societies or
there
whatever.
Are. And who knows? Maybe we could send them some lutefisk, because I know that is about. they all love that from the old country. Now I think it's time to remind people that we have a PayPal account that you can support us from wherever you are in the world, and don't forget to watch Charles's. Programs on YouTube. The link will be provided in the description of this program. And We have two more items on the agenda.
Great.
The first one is regarding Iran. Of course, you noticed the nationwide demonstrations in all over Iran after that Kurdish lady was died in police custody because three strands of her hair had been showing under her hijab. I know they call it something differently, but and that was violating public morale, said the behavioral police or the, yeah. She died, and even the daughter of the former Iranian president, Rafsanjani, was arrested for taking part in these demonstrations. Tuesday night, the Iran soccer team, who's qualified for the World Championships in Qatar next month, played a friendly against Senegal in Austria. And you know what? We might be able to get that tweet, but I'll put it in the description anyway. The soccer team wore black Nike jackets across their suits, thereby not showing the emblem of Hezbollah and of the mullahs. And this was taken as a huge support for the ladies and for the people who wants to get rid of the mullahs. And right before I went to the studio, I got a message from a reliable source that Iran the last week has been shipping foreign currency like hell out of the country, even though they want to have foreign currency. And guess where they sent it?
Switzerland.
Venezuela. And Venezuela has allegedly become the new hotspot for mullahs who are tired of the sand in Iran. They want to have some sea water and tanning in Venezuela, which is also an economy we could spend hours talking about. And finally, there has been a rumor circulating for more than 6 months that the big boss himself, Ayatollah Khamenei, has been ill from cancer. Now, recently, these rumors have popped up again, and now they said he's actually dead. So there is a lot of trepidation in the area. Iran fired lots of ballistic missiles and drones on Kurdish Iranian positions or villages, actually refugee camps near to Sulaymaniyah, north in Iraq and Iraqi Kurdistan, the beginning of this week. And I think that people of Iran and the area are hoping, could we really manage to topple them? I leave that as an open question, though.
Well, it's interesting. I have many exile friends, but in addition, in recent years, the folks at the Tehran Times and some other local Iranian media have reached out to me, have interviewed me. And I have to say that there's something called Press TV I was on for a while. And even though we might violently disagree or passionately disagree on certain topics, these are highly educated people, thoughtful people, a rich culture. And America, as an American, I don't really think I can have much to say about how Iran should be organized, given our dreadful foreign policy misadventures, either supporting the Shah or opposing the current regime. But the one thing I think we can say is that whatever model you want to choose, the present model that's been operating since 79 in Iran has failed at least one generation, arguably almost two generations of people. In a country rich with tradition, rich with resources, this cannot be the best that Iran can produce under this regime, which is said, and it may be propaganda, is said to be very corrupt, is said for all its religiosity, it is said to be skiving off money at the level of maybe 10 or even higher percent of the revenues of these state-owned companies. And meanwhile, the people are in diabolical shape. And then you go back to 2009, when, I'm just kidding a little bit, but gently, maybe not so much, when the Nobel Peace Prize Committee decided to give an oaf, Barack Obama, the Peace Prize on the basis of no accomplishments. One thing he didn't do in his administration in 2009 is stand up for NEDA and others who tried in the, I think it was a Green Revolution, who were trying to advance causes that in this country we would say are progressive, you know, more rights for women, more tolerance. And that 2009 thing was brutally stamped down. People think that the same thing might happen in 2022. I hope not. But it's good to see more focus on this place, which deserves a better present and future.
Definitely. I agree with that. Just a side note, Obama didn't do anything, as you correctly said. But a few years later, he sent how many plane loads of money to the Mullah regime?
Well, we could go on and on about that. I think that's the influence of Valerie Jarrett, who is an American who was born in Shiraz, I think, because her father was a doctor there working for an odious family. We won't get into which one, in Iran. So the strange, intricate nature and tangled web of elite families in the U.S. and around the world, and people who are prepared to let this regime go on and on, is a subject that should be investigated dispassionately by knowledgeable people once we get to the next place in what's going on in Iran.
Agreed. For our grand finale of today, we haven't spoken about COVID for a long time, and we're definitely not going to speak about COVID today either. And we're not going to touch upon the vaccine. But I can't help to bring up a story that was just brought to my attention by someone, that Anthony Fauci's net worth increased over 70% since the COVID started.
Right. Well, you know, this is almost the same thing, you know, with the Biden family and frankly with the Clinton family and other dynastic political families. The amount of money spent fighting COVID that we know about is on the order of magnitude of $5 trillion. That's a lot of money. For Fauci, let's assume that he did get a taste or he was influenced. I don't want to use the B word. He was influenced, let's say, in the way he shaped policy. For him to only see his net worth go up by $5 million for having sprinkled $5 trillion around the world says to me that if he was getting a taste, he doesn't even know how to price his services properly. But beyond that, it's absurd. It's absurd that a government official, in theory, the most highly paid government official Fauci has been over, you know, the last several decades, it's absurd that this man would have a net worth like this from government service. I'm sorry. I mean, you shouldn't be able to generate $12.5 million or whatever it is over his odious lifetime of, I guess, 60 years of government service on a government salary. It's ridiculous. It's preposterous that you would be able to do that. And so if nothing else, we need to have a real tough regulatory regime. If you want to go and tell everybody you've sacrificed in your life for public service, then sacrifice. Don't accumulate $12.5 million in net worth somehow inexplicably.
Charles, he might have been able to price his services better than what it appears that he has done. For all we know, he could have accounts in Venezuela or Singapore or Hong Kong, too. We don't know.
Well, or art.
We're not going to speculate either, Charles. As right. I told you, we have a line of people. More recordings are going to be done this afternoon. It was great to have you on, as usual. And let's pray that we have a peaceful week. But still, for sure, we will have a lot to talk about next Friday, too.
Thank you, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.